Football Show on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well,
to
do it then.
Country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
You're welcome along to Wednesday's football show. Nathan and Dan with you this evening. 53106 is the text number. You can leave a comment if you're watching on facebook.com/offtheball or on YouTube, or you can catch us on Periscope at Off the Ball on Twitter. I can't remember how Where in the World worked, Dan. How'd you earn points? Was it just a test of geography?
I can't really remember, to be honest. Yeah.
Well, should have asked.
Yeah. We should have.
That gives me something to talk about the next time we meet.
You could recreate
it away from
the awkward tickets,
the Liverpool situation.
Yeah, no, you could maybe recreate it. Like,
what if I just got tickets for
have a studio
Liverpool
here,
Napoli?
Yeah,
I have an idea. Oh my God, this is such a great idea. We could do this. So you know this Liverpool Napoli game, Liverpool with all their stars against an exciting Napoli team.
You've just
team.
Given it away live on air. That would have been the perfect plan.
So we do a off the ball fan studio.
Okay.
So we take over one of the boxes. We get somebody else to pay for it. Right.
Yes,
take over one of the boxes. Yeah. We bring some guests, some Liverpool supporting guests. We have a few drinks. We have a nice relaxing day.
Steady.
And we bring Teresa Lowe. Right?
Yeah.
And we have a live
Where in the world? Make it happen.
This could be one of the great days on Off the Ball.
You can make it happen. There's got to be a sponsor out there.
It's got to be.
That'll come on board with this.
Get in touch. Please do.
This
DM me on Twitter. We could even just do it as a mixer.
Yeah.
Easily work. No problem at all.
Yeah, I can't remember what the format was. I assume questions and answers. That'd be my guess.
Well, we have Where in the World details from JP. Where in the World was an Irish quiz show presented firstly by Marty Whelan.
Did he?
What? No, I don't remember that. Maybe for one episode and they decided, no, we need to get Teresa Lowe in here.
We
all love a bit of Marty, yeah. But come on, this is Teresa Lowe's gig. Broadcast for 9 series from 1987 to 1996. Our formative years, Dan. It ended at a good time because Sunday nights, we were starting to lose focus a little bit by 96, I'd say.
You reckon?
I definitely think so. Yeah. The show featured two teams of four made up of two families, which we now know to be a lie.
A sham.
Answering a series of geography-based questions.
There you go.
Wow.
Yeah, see, my dad a geography teacher, so...
Your dad? I never mentioned that.
I had an advantage. Yeah.
Were they all geography teachers? Four geography teachers?
No, I don't think so. No, I'm trying to think. I'm trying to figure out the makeup of the team.
Was it like Blackboard Jungle, where there was a first round and then it progressed to a quarterfinal, semi-final,
no,
final?
No, I don't think so.
So this was... You got your one chance.
I think it was a standalone gig. It was your one shot at glory.
Was there a loser's prize?
They wouldn't know. They wouldn't know. They only went there to win. They only went there to win.
Wow. I think that's a great idea. A live Where in the World. Teresa Lowe. Listen, there's a lot of football shows to come over the summer.
There's a World Cup. Yeah.
We've got a good month to fill between now and the World Cup.
That's going to be a void, yeah.
And if she's just hanging around outside, we've got to utilise these talents that are just amongst us.
Yeah, as I said, you got the studio. You just need some prizes, sponsor, and to remember what the format of the show actually
was.
Well,
I'm sure we can find it on YouTube and figure something out.
We can do that.
All right, so the Europa League final, 20 minutes remaining. Atletico Madrid heading towards victory. Antoine Griezmann loves it in Lyon. Scored twice against Ireland and has scored twice against Marseille. Two really neat finishes. It's up to 29 goals for the season now, having fallen a little bit flat over the opening months. And I won't say not.
It's like Atletico in some ways.
Exactly.
You know?
And maybe his form lives up to their form. It really does feel, even though I'm sure Manchester United fans are looking like this and hoping and praying that they will go back in, it does look as though he's going to Barcelona during the summer.
Yeah, and it's probably the natural evolution for him, you would think, in his career. I mean, there's obviously a certain sadness about it because you want Atletico to try and remain competitive and that it doesn't just become sort of a duopoly, you know, that's just the way it is. But you feel it's inevitable at some stage and that is the soundings. And I mean, this game we spoke about a bit earlier on, that if they scored first, you would sort of fear for it because they have the sort of this match winning ability to sort of maintain control from there, and so it's proved. Marseille have had a bit of a go the last 5-10 minutes, but they're just missing something. They're just missing quality, missing that bit of composure, and it's cost them.
They had a brilliant chance inside 3 minutes to take the lead, very much like Griezmann's opening goal, where they got in behind, but the Marseille striker just blasted way over. Then Dimitri Payet went off injured after half an hour, and really since then, it's been all Atletico Madrid. From kickoff, they kick the ball straight into the corner, Marseille, which is something they've done in every game this season.
It's like territorial.
So they put it out of play for a throw-in for Atletico Madrid, right down by the corner flag, and just piled everyone up and put a bit of pressure on them.
Well, that's just laying down, you know, go long, play for second balls.
You don't see it often, like, it's...
No.
In some ways, okay, it looks ridiculous, but it's also a little bit innovative.
That is just that
don't
pressure.
See, because obviously, the first time you see it, you think, betting scam.
No.
Betting
no.
scam, 100%. In the Europa League final, of all things. But they've done it in
hidden
every
in
game
sight.
This season.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there you go. I mean, if Big Sam did that, he wouldn't get away with it. It would just be like, well, he's just playing a long ball to the corner flag.
Every game. Maybe that was part of the problem this season.
It's just, you
maybe
know,
there was an ulterior motive see, that he just kept to himself.
It's the eyes in which you see it through, you know. It's innovative of someone else, you know, and through certain coaches' mindsets, just direct.
Well, we will chat to the BBC's chief football correspondent, Phil McNulty, in around 20 minutes' time. Maybe there was something else going on with Sam Allardyce. He's going to be talking about Allardyce's exit from Everton. But right now, delighted to be joined on the line by Rory Smith, New York Times chief soccer correspondent and author of Mr. The Men Who Thought the World Had to Beat England at Their Own Game, available now in paperback. Good to talk to you, Rory.
How are you doing?
So is this the England squad that's going to reverse their fortunes?
No. Well, it depends what you mean by reverse their fortunes, I guess. I think it's a squad that is younger than normal, a bit fresher than normal. It feels a bit more exciting, a bit more likeable. They're not going to win the World Cup, but they might do well enough to restore a bit of faith in the England team, I think.
What's Gareth Southgate's thinking then about this young England squad and going with some of the more inexperienced players, including Trent Alexander-Arnold, 19 years of age, never been capped, leaving out the likes of Joe Hart, Ryan Bertrand, Chris Smalling, even Gary Cahill wasn't sure was he in or was he out. Eventually he was selected, but looks to be maybe potentially fourth choice centre-back in this squad. Is he thinking medium term? Is he thinking more about Euro 2020 than this World Cup?
No, because if an England manager came out and said, I'm going to jack this one in and we're going to think about 2020 or 2022, the tabloids in England would be furious. I think, realistically, yes, he's thinking that what they need to do is build a team. And the FA, to their credit, and it's not often you can give the FA a huge amount of credit, they have been quite big in recent years on kind of trying to bring a generation through together, almost. That's what the Spanish and the Germans tend to do, that you'll see the same sorts of players playing for the 17s, for the 19s, for the 21s, and then going in, four or five of them going into the seniors together. And I think Southgate, because he's been involved with the youth levels of England, is really keen to kind of continue that process. So he's wanted to bring through a group of players who will be kind of the core of the England team for the next 4 or 5 years. But that said, yeah, there's a couple of slightly weird ones. I think Alexander-Arnold, without question, deserves to be there. You know, he's been a regular starter for a Liverpool team that's made the Champions League final. It's not like he's come out of nowhere. I think what's slightly strange is that he's not been called up previously this season, that he's not even been given a chance in a friendly, which means he's going into the World Cup without a single cap, which is an unusual situation. A lot of the others, Southgate's telegraphed, Smalling's not been in the squad for a while. There were doubts over Joe Hart. And the other thing is that he's made it clear he's picking on form, not reputation. And I think that's really important. Something that England have always struggled with, this idea that just because you used to be quite good at football, you aren't necessarily that good at football anymore. In fact, it's kind of a metaphor for the entire country. But I think Southgate's tried to change that. And he said, look, if players are playing well, and better than kind of bigger name sort of rivals or alternatives, then he's going to go with the players who are playing well. And he's done that, and credit to him, he's had the courage of his conviction.
It's very much at odds with what we've seen from previous England managers, and I'm sure it was a huge source of frustration to supporters of so many clubs, that there was a feeling if you were playing for one of the top four or maybe even one of the top six, if you were in their squad, you were almost automatically in the England squad. But you mentioned there somebody like Chris Smalling, who's played a huge amount of football for Manchester United this season, who's won Premier League titles. Actually, he's looked at Smalling as a footballer, the way he wants this England team to play, and realises, no, you just don't fit the bill for this. I'm looking for a different type of footballer. There's a bravery in that.
There is, and I still think it's an advantage to be playing for a Liverpool or a Man United or a Chelsea or an Arsenal. I'm sure that helps because it means you're getting exposure in the Champions League or the Europa League and in those really big kind of high-pressure games in the Premier League. But to an extent, it's been forced upon him because those teams are now Liverpool and Spurs apart, maybe. There's not a vast amount of English representation at those teams. So Southgate has to look at the tier of Premier League teams just below that. And that is a good thing, I think, because it means you're selecting players who are playing regularly rather than players who are sort of third-choice central defenders at Manchester City. And that will... That must give those players kind of a bit more rhythm, a bit more momentum, and also it means they kind of showcase their abilities a bit more. They're not being picked just because, you know, they were signed a year ago by a major team and haven't really fitted in since then. That I think contributes to the fact that this England team does feel a bit fresher than previous iterations. It doesn't feel like it's the sort of team that the country is kind of primed to turn on. That sounds a little bit negative, but in previous years going into tournaments, you've always felt that, well, almost when they name the squad, you can work out who the scapegoats are going to be when they get knocked out in the last 16, and it doesn't feel like that anymore. It feels a bit more like the country's a bit more realistic than normal and a little bit more supportive, perhaps, than normal. The players don't seem to have identified that necessarily. We've quite a few, including Raheem Sterling, have come out and said that, you know, they know that people are waiting for them to fail, but I genuinely don't think that's the case this time. I may be proved wrong when Senegal knocked them out in the last 16, but at this point, I think it's fair to say.
So Rory, what is a good tournament for England then? I mean, what is you talk about maybe there's a less expectation there to a point, or less unreasonable expectation. So, what is an acceptable return going there?
Well, it depends who you ask. So I'm not a massive England fan, I've got to say. I don't necessarily go into the tournament supporting them. But to me, I think if England gets to the quarterfinals, then you have to say that is a just above par performance. That's kind of where England should be. If you're in the eight best teams in the world, there is nothing to complain about. England doesn't have a God-given right to be in the semis or the final, and there are four, five, six teams who you could name straight off the bat who are better than England: Spain, France, Germany, Argentina, Brazil, and possibly Belgium, I guess. So I would say the quarterfinals is where they should be aiming for, and if they get knocked out in the quarterfinals when they, you know, play Brazil or Germany, who are the two likely opponents, then you just kind of have to sort that one up and say that, fair enough, England have done what they were meant to do. I think the last 16 is one of those funny things where it can be a success depending on who you play in the last 16. If you go out to a country that you maybe feel that you have the resources or the talent to do better than, someone like Poland, for example, who were a possible opponent in the last 16, I think then you can count that as a bit of a disappointment. And obviously going out in the group stages is without question, it is a disappointment. The group stage draw is kind. The last 16 draw will be a little bit unusual because it will be Colombia, Senegal or Poland, and it's hard to say how England will match up to Colombia and Senegal because obviously they're such kind of different... they're countries that they have very little experience of facing. And then once you come to the quarterfinals and you're facing the big boys, then I think that's when you'd expect England to fall short. So it's one of those three, really. Group stage, they should get through the group stage. They should get through the last 16, probably, and go out in the quarterfinals. And I think that would be acceptable.
I mean, Rory, you mentioned sometimes when the squad is named, you can see the scapegoat. But the flip side of that is sometimes there's a discussion over who should be there. You know, I can't believe he left them at home. I mean, is it possible that Wiltshire or Lallana, that they become that talking point this time? Or is there anything that stands out to you as particularly contentious that they've been omitted from the squad?
I think Lallana's the one who'll be really disappointed because if he's fully fit, he starts for England. But the fact is, he's only played three games this season. He's only started three games for Liverpool this season. So you can see why Southgate has decided to omit him. He should be fit for the Champions League final, Lallana, but he's not played very much football, so he would be going in rusty. I think you can understand that decision. Wiltshire is a bit more contentious because although he's got injury problems, he does potentially offer England something that there is no alternative to. And you wonder whether against a mass defence, which is what you're expecting to face against Panama or Tunisia, whether someone like Wiltshire might have been quite helpful. Technically, he's very good, and there's maybe a shortage of that in the England midfield as well with players like Henderson and Dyer. But that said, because England isn't picking from a particularly rich scene, there's not vast sort of numbers of alternatives to the players who are in the squad who are without question of the quality required. I think there's probably less scope for controversy than normal. So there will be people, Arsenal fans prime among them, I imagine, who feel Wiltshire should be in the squad. But equally, because of Wiltshire's injury history, you know why he's not. So it's really hard to turn that into a massive talking point. I think it's potentially they might miss him a little bit, that he could have added something that isn't there currently. But at the same time, you can understand Southgate's thinking. It's all quite logical, if I'm completely honest.
Mm. It does look as though it's a squad somewhat lopsided in terms of talent, particularly if everyone was firing in all cylinders, Harry Kane, Marcus Rashford, Raheem Sterling, Jamie Vardy as the three attacking options, perhaps Dele Alli playing just in behind. There is talent there that could do a lot of damage if Southgate builds a pretty solid base around them.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing for me is why he's so wedded to a three-man defence. So he sort of made this tactical switch about a year ago, and that does seem to be the way he's planning on playing with Kyle Walker, John Stones, and Harry Maguire as the three first choice central defenders. I'm not convinced that gets the most out of the areas, as you say, in which England have the greatest strength. So the midfield looks a little bit fragile to me. It looks a little bit weaker than normal. If you compare England's midfield to Germany's midfield, even the midfield of players that Germany haven't taken to the World Cup, England's midfield doesn't begin to compare. So you feel as though where England are strongest is up front, as you say, with Kane, with Vardy, with Sterling, Dele Alli as well, who I think is in danger of missing out for a starting place, depending on how Southgate plays. But he seems to have got this idea that the three-man defence kind of makes the most sense. I'm not convinced that's true, but that said, I'm not England manager, so it may well be that I'm wrong. And it'll be interesting to see how Southgate kind of tweaks it against different opponents and how, as the tournament goes on, he changes things around to get the players who are kind of clicking, who are in really good form, into the team. Because that's always what happens in tournaments. You go in with one plan, and then suddenly you notice that somebody else is playing really, really well, and you have to change things around. And that will be the test of Southgate's kind of tactical acumen, I think, how he can respond in that situation.
Is the expectation that they would play attractive football, that they'll try and get it down, try and outpass teams, or is this very much set up with a three-man defence with the two wing-backs to get teams on the counter?
I think the former. I think Southgate's made it clear that he wants a sort of possession-based style. He wants England to be patient, certainly more patient than they normally are. He wants them to try and build the play. That's what he's done. It's what he did for the under-21s. It's how all the England youth teams are trained to play now. And it's what he's done in his games in charge of the senior team. I think the problem they might have is that could be a little bit sterile, because that sort of possession-based Barcelona, Spain style of football works best when you have players who are capable of making those incisive forward passes, who will take risks in possession. And looking at England's midfield, with the possible exception of Dele Alli, I'm not sure they have those players. So it could well be that England do have this really exciting forward line with Harry Kane, who's scored 30 goals in the Premier League 3 years in a row and probably the best English striker since Shearer. You've got Jamie Vardy, who's in great form. Sterling, who's had an incredible season for City. But whether they can make the most of that, given that the players providing them with the ball are a little bit more naturally cautious, I think that's the big issue. So they will play, they will try and play attractive football, but it may be that they're kind of susceptible to what Arsene Wenger used to call sterile domination, where they have a lot of possession but don't do a vast amount with it.
There's not a lot of experience. Gary Cahill is the only player in the squad with over 40 caps. The goalkeepers between them are barely into double figures in terms of caps. And probably the story that's garnered most attention over the last 48 hours is Joe Hart. And it seems he's very upset with David Moyes in particular for dropping him from the West Ham side. And he feels that ultimately is what cost him his place. We don't know a huge amount, say, personality-wise about Butland, Pickford and Pope. It looks as though it is going to be Jordan Pickford who starts. England do have some experience of starting inexperienced goalkeepers, and it never seems to end particularly well. Is it possible to describe the type of pressure that's on an England goalkeeper and an England team in the first game of a World Cup and what they have to deal with mentally?
Well, I think what they have to deal with and what will be the big test for Pickford, and I think you're right, it should be Pickford who starts, is that any mistake at all, because obviously the World Cup, even the group stages, there's not a vast amount of margin for error. Any mistake at all will be seized upon, and there is a possibility that you will be kind of, not public enemy number one, but lampooned and mocked and become a meme for you know, one slip, one misjudgment. I think Pickford and Butland, and to an extent Pope, are probably all capable of dealing with that. You know, Butland's been a Premier League player for a long time. Pickford's been at Everton in a difficult season, which in a sense might be quite good preparation for him if things were to go wrong. I think in terms of leaving Hart behind, it does make sense. As I say, Southgate wanted to pick on form and rather than on reputation. And Joe Hart's not been playing, and he wasn't dropped because, you know, because he advertised his head and shoulders or because David Moyes took a dislike to him. He was dropped because he was letting in loads of goals. I think the way he's responded to being dropped is by England is really, really strange. I'm for a player who's who's kind of carved out a reputation as being someone who's always willing to front up, who's always willing to, you know, to stand up and be counted, to try and pass the buck on to your club manager, who clearly made a decision that it was in the club's best interest for you not to be playing in goal because you were not playing well. That seems a really strange thing for a senior player to do. You could maybe understand it of a younger player who hadn't been through those situations before. But Joe Hart really should be looking at why he was dropped by David Moyes and thus why he's not in the England squad, rather than thinking it's David Moyes' fault that he's not in the England squad.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say that, Roy. I would have thought the speed to which it's come out that he's unhappy, and clearly, you know how these things play, you know, people are being briefed with this or that. I think there's an element that vindicates the decision to leave him out. Surely that there seems to... You'd sort of worry about that type of stuff. There have been England players over the years when they've been dropped or when something's been going wrong. You hear about it very, very quickly, about their unhappiness.
It feels as though he has maybe slightly misjudged the public mood, that maybe by getting this out before the squad was announced that he was hoping to be some sort of national outrage or something, yeah, that Joe Hart, our number one, isn't in the squad. And, well, really, it feels, Rory, it's sort of just been met by a sort of shrug of the shoulders by everybody.
Yeah, well, I think the country as a whole, I don't want to speak for England, but I think that the country as a whole had accepted that Joe Hart was a fading force about 2 years ago, and you hear very little about Pep Guardiola's decision to jettison him, because I think everyone understands why Guardiola didn't want Hart as goalkeeper, not just because of the perceived weakness with, you know, playing out from the back, but because he is a very big character, and what we've seen from in the last sort of 24, 36 hours is that he is prepared to put his side of the story there, and he's not afraid to make it known when he's happy or unhappy. But as you say, I think it's a misjudgment, really, of not just of the public mood that people aren't that upset that Joe Hart's not in the England squad, but also the situation. Most footballers that you speak to are naturally quite sort of self-reflective and analytical, and they understand that if they have a professional setback, that the message that you take from that is that they have to improve. Players are actually really good at that, as a rule, in my experience. And Joe Hart doesn't seem to have read that at all. He seems to have blamed somebody else for the fact that he was dropped. And, you know, he was dropped because he was conceding goals, and Adrian came in and did better than him, so Joe Hart didn't get back in the team. And that's kind of how football works. And normally what you'd hear from a player in that situation is, I've got to work harder and get better and try and win my place back first for club, then for country. That doesn't appear to have been Hart's sort of approach. And I think, as you say, quite rightly, that vindicates the decision not to take him, because that's not really the attitude you want in a World Cup squad, I would assume. That's kind of the opposite of what you want.
All right, good stuff, Rory. Thanks a lot for taking the call.
Thanks for having me.
Rory Smith there, New York Times chief soccer correspondent, and his book, Mister, The Men Who Taught the World How to Beat England at Their Own Game, is still out and available on paperback. It's interesting, we look at this England squad, and I think, as Rory said right at the start, there's no huge expectation and a feeling that maybe there's a likability factor there and the nation might get behind them and not put the level of pressure. And then in 6 weeks' time, we're going to be sitting here and England have lost 3-0 Senegal, yeah, in the last 16, and Gareth Southgate will be sacked the next morning.
Yeah, or they draw in it all, but Panama having failed to break it down for 90 minutes, because they're actually a bit sterile during the Euros as well. They actually played some nice football at times, but just not really very incisive. But
it's interesting that the formation he wants to play, because he obviously has a set style he wants to implement, but you just think, if you've Kane down the middle, Rashford and Sterling either side, maybe take a real risk and play Dele Alli at the front of a three in midfield.
I'd have Vardy involved in some shape or form. I know that means...
Or maybe Vardy instead of Rashford.
There. Yeah, I mean, they've got good options. Mm. I'm actually a bit surprised Welbeck's going, actually. It's sort of, but it's interesting. I think Martin Neal went to the Euros, brought four strikers, and Southgate's weighting of his squad is slightly different. They're a bit light in that midfield area. If you pick up an injury with sort of Henderson or Dyer...
Fabian Delph
present a few problems. Yeah, I suppose he can swing in there, and they've brought Loftus-Cheek, but that is the one you can see it becoming a talking point. But hey, someone will probably get injured anyway. So
Atletico Madrid are going to win the Europa League. They've just scored a third goal. We're into injury time. Gabby, Marseille had actually played quite well for the last 15 minutes
it
or
has.
So
hit the post. Yeah.
Atletico maybe more open than you would expect for the closing stages, but they broke and the ball was pulled back to Gabby in a really neat finish from inside the penalty area. Atletico Madrid 3, Marseille 0. We're into injury time. We're going to take a quick break and then we're going to talk to the BBC's Phil McNulty about the sacking of Big Sam.
Off the ball. This is News Talk.
Welcome back to the football show. Celebrations in Lyon once again for Antoine Griezmann. He has scored twice to help Atletico Madrid to a 3-0 victory over Marseille in the Europa League final. Yet another victory for La Liga side in this competition. We'll talk to Graham Hunter about it tomorrow night. There was a bit of pressure on Atletico from this since they dropped out of the Champions League. They were the best team in the competition. We've known that all the way through the last 32. There's lots of opportunities to slip up. They did the job.
They got it done. And I mean, Arsene Wenger called it. The semi-finalist victor would comfortably emerge. And so it proved in the end.
All right, let's talk to the BBC's chief football writer, Phil McNulty, who is on the line. Good evening, Phil.
Hi, how are you doing?
So Sam Allardyce has been sacked as Everton manager after just 6 months. He had a contract until June of next year. But was it ever going to be any other way?
It certainly hasn't been any other way for the last couple of months. I think they had a couple of away defeats at Watford and then at Burnley. I think that's when the fan discontent that had been simmering came to the surface. And I think since then, it's only been heading one way. It was an appointment they tolerated, and the Everton fans did tolerate it early on when he got some results. But slowly but surely over time, the style of play became a big issue and the hostility was at the surface. There were protests among the fans and banners and chants, etc. So really, this morning's decision was inevitable in the end.
He did make an instant impact, and any slight worries that were there about a possible relegation fight were quickly quashed. And the way this Premier League season has worked out, we ended up almost with a bottom 10 fighting for relegation. And then you had Everton in there, maybe could have finished 7th or 8th. So there was actually an opportunity where there was pressure off for the last 3-4 months where he could have gone, this is my master plan. This is why I want £100 million to invest this summer. This is the way I want Everton to play. Whereas it felt as though he never got out of that mindset of, we're battling for survival.
I think you've hit the nail right on the head there. I think that when he came in, I mean, he talked about making the team entertaining. And clearly there was an understanding that when he arrived, they were in a bad position. I didn't think they were serious relegation candidates. I thought there were always going to be teams worse than them. But once he got them safe, and that was fairly on in his time there, I think people then said, right, go on, let's see what you can do. Can you fulfil this promise of making them more attractive? He was given £50 million to spend on attacking players in the transfer window in January, but Theo Walcott and Cenk Tosun, two players who've actually done quite well. But the style of play remained the same, pragmatic, to put it kindly, dull, if you want to put it the other way. And it just never, ever sort of got out of first gear. It was, you know, like the 1-1 home draw to Southampton was very typical, hardly any chances. They beat Newcastle 1-0 in a Monday night game, which was a dreadful advert for the Premier League. Everton won with the only shot they had on target. And I think that was the problem. I think he had that opportunity over a period of months to show he could offer more, but he didn't. And that increased the anxiety of the fan base. I think if he'd been given a 6-month contract, they would have waved him on the way today and said, thanks very much, you've done what you said you were going to do. Off you go. But it was the prospect of watching another 12 months of it that I think was at the heart of the discontent. He never struck up any rapport with the Everton fans, plus this problem with the style of play. And I think, as you know as well as I, stuff like that only ends one way.
There was an interesting couple of months there where we got a good insight into what happens at Everton behind the scenes on TalkSport every morning, when Jim White would reveal his conversations with the Everton owner, Farhad Moshiri. It's got a bit quieter over the last few months, but has there been any real soundings from Everton as to what the relationship was like between Allardyce and the club's owners? Were they really wishing for him over the last 3-4 months to implement a more stylish brand of football so that they could keep him on for another year? Or was there always a sense right from the start that, yeah, this will probably be a short-term measure?
I think there was a sense that it would be a short-term measure, but also they wouldn't have minded him doing very well because I think it would have saved them about £6 million today, to be honest with you, in paying him off for the final year of his contract. I just think it's been in recent months a fairly loveless relationship between Everton and Allardyce. I'm never sure he was the unanimous choice of everyone on the Everton board. In fact, I'm fairly certain that he wasn't. But it was a period when they needed to do something. When his name was first mentioned for Everton, of course, hands were thrown up in horror at the idea of Sam Allardyce managing Everton. But in that interim period of 4 or 5 weeks, they never found another manager. They hit a brick wall with Marco Silva. They had poor results. And suddenly people who were against him were thinking, oh, hang on, this is a job for Sam Allardyce. But really, the last couple of months, the whole season's been joyless. But the last couple of months, with all the sort of toxic atmosphere, it really has only been heading one way because it had just gone too far for him to turn it back around the other way. And owners do like to be popular. And I think if Farhad Moshiri announced this morning that Sam Allardyce was staying for another 12 months, he could have had a serious revolt on his hands from the fans. And he didn't want that.
Yeah, Phil. I was going to ask where the owners stand in terms of their popularity and Moshiri, because I mean, various bits and bobs come out today. One of the claims was that I think Moshiri had read Big Sam's autobiography, I think, before appointing him, and this has been referenced. But I mean, at the same time, they've invested money into the club. But is Moshiri sort of unpopular, or where does he stand in terms of the perception?
No, he's not unpopular. I think there's a fairly full reservoir of goodwill for him. He's spent a lot of money on the team. He's shown a willingness to invest. He's taken action when the fans have sort of demanded it, if you like. They didn't want Martinez, so he went. They'd turned against Koeman, so he went. And, of course, today he's had a very busy day. He's been dismissing people left, right and centre. Allardyce has gone. Steve Walsh, the director of football, has gone. Marcel Brands, who's got a huge reputation with his work with PSV and AZ in Holland, he's come in as the director of football. So I think he is in the good books today. I think what I will say is that it's the last few weeks is the first time he's been questioned. Not so much criticised, but questioned about, is he leading the club from the front? Is he letting it drift? Is he too busy delegating? People wanted a show of leadership from him. And today they've got that in terms of him sacking his manager and also in terms of bringing in the director of football. So I wouldn't say he's unpopular at all. In fact, I think he remains largely popular. But definitely questions are being asked for the first time about whether he was taking them in the right direction and whether he was doing enough to influence that right direction. Today, I think he's taken steps towards addressing that, certainly.
The sacking of Steve Walsh as director of football is arguably a bigger story than Sam Allardyce going, because theoretically, the way these things should work is managers come and go, but the director of football stays with the overall vision for the club. And it was quite a coup to get him in from Leicester, where he'd brought in Vardy and Kante and Mahrez and received huge credit for their win at the title. What's gone wrong then with Steve Walsh and his role within the club? Why has that come about that they've ended up sacking him?
I think I just wonder whether he was overpromoted. I think he was a scout at Leicester and a very, very good one, as you said, and he hit this purple patch at Leicester City where he was producing these players for bargain fees that ended up winning them the title. Really, he was a very good scout. A director of football, I think, is a completely different thing. I was never sure there was a great relationship between himself and Koeman. Not in that they disliked each other, but they never quite seemed on the same page when talking about recruitment. I think this is a completely different situation. Everton today have appointed a guy in Brands who is a proven director of football. I think he'll be calling the shots now, and the manager will come in and work with him. And obviously he will have a hand in the appointment of the manager, which wasn't quite the same with Koeman and Walsh. Koeman was appointed, then Walsh came in. It was sort of an arranged marriage, if you like. I'm talking a lot about marriages tonight, aren't I? Loveless marriage, arranged, whatever. Anyway, an arranged marriage between Koeman and Walsh, which never quite worked. And unfortunately, someone like Walsh is going to be judged on his transfer strategy. And the transfer strategy at Everton has been a fiasco, really. I mean, imbalanced squad. Three number 10s signed in Sigurdsson, Klaassen and Rooney. And perhaps most criminally of all, if you like, they sold Romelu Lukaku for £90 million and then never brought anyone in to replace him until January, when they bought Tosin from Besiktas. Really, he's had a nightmarish time. And again, over the last couple of months, he's been living on borrowed time. There was a suggestion that he might be demoted, if you like, and put down to a scouting role again, which clearly is his strength. But in the end, they've just decided to get rid of him altogether. So in many ways, Everton are almost starting again now. The model Moshiri wanted when he brought Koeman in 2016, he's thrown out his first effort at it, and now he's started again. Obviously, that will then follow with the appointment of the manager. But the director of football is a key appointment. He's gone for someone who's got a huge reputation throughout Europe in Brands, and I think he will lead the show from now on. And the manager will be signed off by him, which I think makes a big difference.
Moshiri, it wasn't his first time he's dipped his toes into football. He'd been involved with Arsenal, but it was seen last summer as though he'd made a lot of rookie mistakes, that he almost got carried away as if it was somebody who'd won the lotto, a fan buying the club. Let's bring back Wayne Rooney because it's what the supporters want. Or Gylfi Sigurdsson for 40 million, he was brilliant last year. Rather than a long-term plan how to invest, which you would expect of someone from that sort of experience. Do you think now with the change of director of football, he's going to take a lesser role and hand a lot more of the power to the new guy?
I think so. I think Brands now will run the show at Everton. They've got a new chief executive, which they, who they appointed last night as well, who's been on the board for about an in-house appointment, that one. But I think Brands is the key appointment now, and they're really delighted to have got him. But I also think, yes, he was at Arsenal, but he was only a minor shareholder at Arsenal. He didn't have his hands on the controls, if you like. This is where he is different at Everton. He's the owner. He is soon, to, I think, to become the majority shareholder. I mean, he's got 49.9%, so he effectively owns the club anyway, but I think he's trying to increase that. So he was learning on the job, if you like. And to be fair, lots of what they did last summer was good. They brought in Jordan Pickford, who has proved to be a really good signing. And lots of people who they signed that people are complaining about now, they greeted them with open arms last year, but it was that imbalance of these three number 10s that they signed. Really, they only needed one of them, not three. And again, that key thing that I keep going back to, they never replaced Romelu Lukaku, which really almost falls under the category of negligence. You lose your top goal scorer, you get £90 million for him, and then you don't replace him. I mean, that takes some explaining away if you're the director of football or you're the manager. They talked about having Olivier Giroud in the building, but it's no good having him in the building if he's not going to sign. And that really sort of holed them below the waterline even before the season started, really. It was a terrible error, and they paid a very, very heavy price for it.
Marco Silva and Sean Dyche were the two names most heavily linked before Sam Allardyce got the job. Are they the likely names they go after again, or is it a case now with Marcel Brands coming in that they might actually be looking in a completely different direction?
Well, I'm never sure there was any serious interest in Sean Dyche, which will come as a surprise to lots of people given what he's done at Burnley this season. But certainly Silva was Mashiri's first choice when Ronald Koeman was sacked. They got involved in a very acrimonious discussion with Watford, where Watford were very angry about Everton coming in for Silva. Watford ended up sending a cease and desist legal letter to Everton to tell them to back off, which they did. Everton were prepared to pay £12 or £15 million. And the other strand to this is that at that time, Watford complained to the Premier League that alleging that Everton had spoken to Silva without their permission. Now, that complaint is still on the table, if you like. It's still to be dealt with by the Premier League. So that might just come into play and delay things a little if Everton want Silva, who is their top target. Paulo Fonseca from Shakhtar Donetsk has been mentioned as an alternative. Of course, he was pictured going into David Sullivan's mansion the other day for discussions over the West Ham job, but nothing's come of that as yet. But I do think Silva is the one they want. I think he's the one they will end up getting. But I think there's still a little bit of work to be done yet because of this diplomatic incident, if you like, over their approach from him in November. I think there's still a little bit of fallout from that that needs to be settled first.
All right, great stuff. Phil, thanks a lot for talking to us this evening.
No problem at all. Thank you.
Phil McNulty there, the BBC's chief football writer, talking about Big Sam getting the boot. Yeah. So the Marco Silva thing may not be that straightforward.
It is interesting because it just goes to show there's a lot of talk sometimes, and if just Big Sam goes and Silva at the end of the season, that's what was said, I think, in October. Mm. And it comes to pass after a lot of sort of dancing around it.
But even though Watford have since sacked Marco Silva, it seems they can go back to the original complaint, and Everton are concerned that they may get done on that and may end up being deducted points.
Yeah,
so they may still have to try and pay some sort of compensation to Watford to get him, even though they fired him.
I just feel like in the Premier League, any legal dispute ultimately, it's just write a check and what do I need to make this go away?
Atletico Madrid are just about to lift the Europa League trophy. There's Fernando Torres. Didn't see him get on, but he still looks as beautiful as ever.
Does he?
I think so. He's still got his childish good looks.
Does he? Oh, okay. I'm gonna take your lead on that.
Do.
Marseille players look very sad, dejected.
They've just lost the Europa League final.
Yeah, but people would like, you know, make you believe it doesn't matter. It does. It does matter. Something like Marseille, that would have been amazing.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.